This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week marks the 5th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. The Man Who Pushed America to War is the title of the new book by my guest Aram Rostin. It's about Ahmed Chalabi. He's the Iraqi exile who affirmed the Bush administration's case that regime change was necessary. Chalabi lobbied Congress to support the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, and he provided the Iraqi sources to journalists and congressmen who said that Saddam Hussein was developing weapons of mass destruction and had links to al-Qaeda. Chalabi led the Iraqi exile group, the Iraqi National Congress. Who funded Chalabi's work? The CIA, then the State Department. Aram Rostin is an investigative journalist with the NBC Nightly News. He's covered Iraq, Chalabi, and the reconstruction of Iraq for NBC. He's also written for the New York Times Magazine, Mother Jones, Washington Monthly, and The Nation. Aram Rostin, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we get into the details describing what Chalabi did to help get the United States to invade Iraq, let's just get to a brief overview of what his role was in the invasion of Iraq.
A lot of people think the war in Iraq wouldn't have even happened without Ahmad Chalabi. Whether that's true or not, that's what a lot of people believe who are supporters of his, and that's what a lot of people believe who are really resentful of him. And that is what he's claimed in the past. He's had a tremendous influence on what America did when it chose to go to war in Iraq.
When did the CIA start funding him?
They first approached him in 1991, in the spring of 1991, when they were looking for somebody to organize this opposition group. It was really important for them to find somebody who was a credible Iraqi, they thought, who could bring together lots of different Iraqi opposition members. And they found him. They looked to him because they knew his reputation as a fixer, really.
Would you say that Chalabi, with the help of the CIA and CIA funding, built a genuine, credible group of Iraqi exile opposition leaders, or did he just give the appearance of doing that?
Some people think that in the early 90s, when the Iraqi National Congress first started, it may have been something like a legitimate umbrella group that could bring together the Iraqi opposition, the people who were outside Iraq, because obviously inside Iraq they couldn't do anything. So they thought maybe this is something real. But in the end, towards the end, I think very few people saw it that way. It's had several lives, the Iraqi National Congress has. It's had several lives over the last, well over a decade. But it was the only group that existed in any case. If it didn't exist, there wasn't any that did exist.
You say the dynamic changed between the CIA and Chalabi. Instead of Chalabi being dependent on the CIA became dependent on him. In what way were they dependent on Ahmed Chalabi?
In the early 90s, the CIA wanted Chalabi to be, under their control, of course, an agent of influence, one could call it. But he didn't become that. He seemed to just get along with them wonderfully. The officers who handled him in the beginning were very pleased. But then suddenly, when he controlled the purse strings, when he seemed to have influence, they felt it was clear he began pursuing his own agenda. And he felt he was perfectly in the right to do that. His feeling was he was never a CIA asset at all. He never was a CIA agent in his mind. He was doing what he wanted. And so the CIA lost control of him because once he began to really take control of the Iraqi National Congress, the CIA began to really lose control of the Iraqi National Congress that they were paying for, that the American taxpayer was paying for.
Well, were Chalabi's goals with the Iraqi National Congress different from the CIA's goals?
It's a key question. The CIA's goals are actually not that easy to define either. The CIA was tasked with trying to come up with a plan to overthrow Saddam Hussein. The Iraqi National Congress was one component of that plan, but in officers' minds, there's no way the Iraqi National Congress could have overthrown Saddam Hussein on their own. It just was inconceivable. But for Ahmad Chalabi, that was his mission, to overthrow Saddam Hussein. He really began using the Iraqi National Congress as a means to lobby and a means to propagandize the world so that the world would eventually invade Iraq and topple Saddam Hussein, doing what they hadn't done in the first Gulf War.
How credible was he? I mean, he had left Iraq, was it 1958? After the monarchy was overthrown. And then his family was a banking family. They owned banks in Lebanon. Correct me if I'm wrong on any of this here.
That's all right.
And after the CIA started funding him, he was charged with embezzlement and other charges as well, I think, in the Petra Bank, a family bank in Lebanon. What was he charged with exactly in relationship with this bank?
The Petra Bank was a major Jordanian bank that he founded, he ran, and he ran it virtually on his own. In 1989, it collapsed. The Jordanians took it over. The next year, they began liquidation proceedings against it. There was a huge investigation by Jordan into what happened there. And he was charged with, in essence, embezzlement and fraud. And then there were a lot of other charges. He was eventually convicted of a number of them. Chiefly, he was convicted of fraud and embezzlement. And in essence, what Chalabi was accused of doing, the major cases against him, involved lending money to businesses that were associated with his family. And then those businesses didn't pay the money back. That's the way I read the judgment of the Jordanian court.
And this didn't trouble the CIA, who was giving him millions of dollars.
You know, it's odd. They have people, there's no institutional memory of it anymore at the CIA, of course. But the people who were involved say, well, you know, the CIA always works with complex people. We don't work with angels. And we didn't expect him to be, you know, we wanted somebody we can work with. So, you know, that was one of their one attitude. The other attitude was, you know, in other words, they didn't really care. The other thing, it hadn't really come to a head yet. It makes no sense, as you point out. It's hard to understand what the CIA was doing. The CIA worked very closely with the government of Jordan on the one hand, very closely with the royal family of Jordan, and yet here they were funding somebody who was really on the other side of the government of Jordan, and who the government of Jordan had accused of a crime. So it really made no sense, and yet it happened. It's hard to explain how that happened, but it's one of the curious things about Ahmad Chalabi.
When he was getting millions of dollars from the CIA, was that money laundered? I mean, he wasn't writing checks on CIA checkbooks.
It's a really key question, right? The CIA doesn't just hand out money saying CIA on it, and he didn't want it to appear that he was getting money from the CIA. He was really mysterious to his Iraqi colleagues. It was almost it was clearly very important to him that nobody knew he was getting money from the CIA, that nobody knew the agency, that his operations were funded by the CIA. And so there were all these sort of myths he propagated amongst his fellow Iraqis early on, you know, where he said he was getting money from Iraqi businesses or such, or he implied that he was donating the money. But everybody knew, you know, what had happened. All the Iraqis knew what had happened with Petra Bank and his other family businesses. So they didn't believe that. But they had to hide the source of the funding, which is, of course, the CIA. One way the funding came early on was through a company called the IBC, the Iraqi Broadcasting Company, which he in part owned. And CIA officers told me that, and as well as Iraqi National Congress people. They told me that, too. So that's one way. It was just a broadcasting company, so to speak. And that's one way the agency got funding to the Iraqi National Congress.
So the CIA started funding Chalabi in around 91. They cut him off in around 96, 97. Why did they cut him off?
There was a huge split in the CIA at first, and then there was just anger at Chalabi. There were a number of things that went wrong in Kurdistan, things that went very wrong. First, he would try to launch sort of these uprisings on his own. He would try to launch these, who knows if he was sincere about it, but they would try to launch these sort of quasi-invasion or quasi-coup against Saddam Hussein, and sort of against the knowledge and against the wishes of the CIA. And then later on, the CIA moved its funding towards another effort. They started supporting basically a rival of Ahmad Chalabi, somebody who was a former Ba'athist named Ayad Alawi. And there was this, he was very bitter about that. By then, they no longer trusted him. They began inspecting and auditing where their money was going in the radio stations and newspapers and other operations that they thought they were funding. And they began to realize, you know, maybe he wasn't spending their money as they thought it was being spent. They hadn't really checked on where the money was going. And then, by then, the split got tremendous. The split was just a huge chasm between Chalabi, who they were funding, and the CIA, and they finally ended it. They basically decided to cut all ties with him, basically cauterizing the wound, just cutting him off, as opposed to sort of gently weaning him off. They simply cut off all of his funding, and it clearly he was quite bitter about that.
So explain this to me. The CIA cut off funding for Chalabi. CIA didn't trust Chalabi, and yet eventually the State Department started giving money to Chalabi. How did the State Department end up funding him after the CIA cut him off?
It's really fascinating. Once the CIA had really abandoned him, cut him off, his friends in Congress over time began to really push for funding for him. They specified millions would go to the Iraqi opposition, meaning the Iraqi National Congress. They targeted millions of dollars for him, and it would all have to go through the State Department, often as economic support funds or something like that. But it would go through the State Department. And the State Department was not fond of him necessarily, and they didn't think this was a good idea. They were resistant. So they created these other structures. They created obstacles. But the money wasn't getting to the Iraqi National Congress, to Chalabi, the way the Congress wanted it to during the Clinton administration. They were sort of paying heed to Congress, but they weren't passing the money on. So he was very frustrated. That was under Clinton. And the Democratic administration simply didn't want to fund the Iraqi National Congress, it seemed. But Congress was pushing for it. Capitol Hill was pushing for it. And it was this really weird dynamic in Washington.
Did that change when President Bush was elected?
Yeah, it certainly did. It certainly did, because obviously when President Bush came in, he brought in a lot of people who were very, very supportive of Chalabi and of the Iraqi National Congress. The problem was even that couldn't free up the funding from the State Department. The State Department still, a lot of them were still, they were trying to do it the way that their laws said they had to. You know, they had accountability, they had to give it to incorporated entities, they had to often fund things in certain ways that U.S. law required. And, you know, the Iraqi National Congress just wanted the funding. They wanted the funding to start, you know, they were very busy, they wanted to get to work, and they could start toppling the regime if they just got their money. They were promising these things, and the State Department still continued to sort of resist. But the money did start to flow, eventually. The money really did start to flow in the millions and millions through the proper mechanisms finally were put in place. The State Department funding started, and everything seemed to be going well.
It's interesting that the CIA didn't spread the word on Capitol Hill. We don't trust this guy, Ahmet Chalabi. We work with him. We cut him loose. We don't trust him anymore. Be careful. I mean, the CIA would have ways of doing that, wouldn't they?
They would. They tried. Here's his to a certain degree, genius. He was able to use his animosity to the CIA and their animosity to him to his advantage. There were a large number of people at Capitol Hill who hated the CIA. A lot of people really mistrusted it. They felt it was, well, too liberal, or it was coddling Middle East dictators, or it was intervening and it wasn't allowing sort of a firm, muscular U.S. foreign policy. And Chalabi, to a certain degree, could be used to their advantage, just as he could use these opponents of the CIA to his advantage. So it really worked well for him. He used the CIA's animosity to his advantage to an incredible degree.
During the period leading up to the war in Iraq, how did Chalabi operate on Capitol Hill? How did he use his influence? And what was his technique?
In part, it was sheer force of personality. In part, it was dividing his enemies and creating friends that way. But a lot of it was sheer force of personality. He had an American who was very useful to him, an American ally named Francis Brooke, who was his lobbyist, his advocate, undeclared lobbyist. But they were very informal. They would call up a senator, call up an aide, and they would visit the office, and they would make friends that way. He also had this brilliance where he knew he didn't have to just get to a senator, to a congressman, to the real powerful figures. He had to get to the people who were the aides, the staffers, who do a lot of the work here in Washington. And so he was very good at creating allies and friends there.
Now, something else that Chalabi did after the CIA cut him loose was he got together with the neoconservatives and helped give them their rationale for pushing to invade Iraq, or help supply them more rationale, strengthen their rationale. Who were some of the neoconservatives that Chalabi was in with?
It's almost a notorious group of people now, or a very well-known group. You know, you've got Fife, and you've got Harold Rode, and you've got Richard Pearl, and Paul Wolfowitz. They're a well-known group, really, and they stuck together. And obviously, the neoconservatives are not monolithic. There's a large diversity amongst them. But one of the commonalities they had, one of the things they shared was their fondness for Ahmad Chalabi and his goal. And how he got into that circle was interesting. He'd known Pearl for a long time, but they're really, in the mid-90s, he really did manage to inject Iraq as a key issue that would, he thought, and they became to think, that would change the Middle East. He really had a lot to do with that, and he really influenced the neoconservatives on that. Some of them told me that.
Talk a little bit more about which part of the neoconservative plan came directly from Chalabi.
Well, this ideology, this sort of strategic vision that they had, this idea that once you topple Saddam, everything sort of lines up to work fine. I think Chalabi helped establish it as sort of a strategy in the Middle East to topple Saddam. Toppling Saddam became this overriding solution to the Middle East to them. And it's not necessarily logical or illogical, but that's what their strategy became. Toppling Saddam would then lead to these other good things. Good things would result, peace. Other countries would see that dictators could be toppled, and then the Palestinian-Israeli conflict could be solved somehow. And that's what they began to see, and they saw that in part because of what Chalabi was telling them.
And I guess also that Chalabi was an Iraqi exile who could be a public face and say, this is true, this is what's going to happen.
They really bought into him, and perhaps, you know, they really saw him. Well, this, you know, were they using him? Was he using them? Or did everybody believe what everybody else was saying? I think, to a certain degree, they really, really liked him. It was just genuine. They thought, and they all say this, they thought he was a, quote, Democrat with a small d, somebody who would bring democracy to the Middle East. Whether they really thought that, they speak enthusiastically about that. They thought his values were their values. His values, he was not anti, you know, Zionist. He was not anti-American. He would be pro-U.S., And when he brought that perspective to them, they thought, wow, we've got somebody who we can really work with.
So Ahmad Chalabi made the argument that if you overthrow Saddam Hussein, then peace spreads. Israel and the Palestinians are able to make peace. You know, peace spreads all the way through to the Middle East. And a lot of people believe that. But, you know, it's interesting. We were talking about how the CIA cut him loose and distrusted him. You write that Israel's intelligence service, the Mossad, they distrusted him, too. And even though Chalabi became, for a lot of Americans, he became seen as a kind of pro-Israel figure, Israeli intelligence didn't trust him. Why didn't the Mossad trust him?
It was really interesting for me to learn that the Mossad didn't trust him because he'd had so much support from pro-Israel people here in the United States. But the Mossad didn't trust him for a number of reasons, but chiefly it had to do with something that happened in the past, supposedly. I don't know exactly what it was, but they had some interaction with him, and it hadn't been positive. There was also, you know, their alliance with the U.S., with the CIA, and they simply knew what the CIA's experience was with him. And it apparently they had a lot of experience with the Jordanians and were very familiar with what his history in Jordan was. But what was true was the Mossad was simply, at that point, in 98 and onwards, 97, 98 and onwards, they would not work with him. It was contradicting what a lot of his supporters in the United States were saying. But the Mossad, Israeli intelligence, they had no interest whatsoever in dealing with him.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Aram Rostin, author of the new book, The Man Who Pushed America to War, The Extraordinary Life, Adventures, and Obsessions of Ahmad Chalabi. Chalabi was an Iraqi exile who organized fellow exiles to push for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. He lobbied Congress to support regime change and worked with the neoconservatives who advocated regime change. He was funded by the CIA, then the State Department. Aram Rostin is an investigative journalist who works as a producer for the NBC Nightly News. One of the things that Chalabi is famous for now is having supplied misinformation, or some might say disinformation, to people in Congress, to journalists. What is some of the misinformation that he spread?
Well, there's a number of things. There were specific stories that began to come up after 9/11 that addressed Saddam Hussein and alleged he had ties to Osama bin Laden. There were other stories that came up about Saddam Hussein's ties to WMD and his WMD programs and nuclear programs and so forth. These were the issues that Chalabi and his people really began to push after the tragedy of 9/11. They really tried to bring attention to Saddam Hussein. They tried to tie him to Osama bin Laden. It was a major effort on their part by using these stories that they began to bring before the press, before intelligence, if they could, and before Congress. But the other major part of information that they brought forward were just they sort of still provided. A lot of people got all their information about Iraq from Ahmad Chalabi and his people.
You write in your book that after September 11th, Chalabi and his people pushed four major storylines about Iraq and September 11th. What were those four major storylines?
Just in the weeks after 9/11, the first big storyline that Chalabi and his people were bringing to the U.S., to the media and intelligence services, was this idea that Saddam Hussein's Iraq had trained hijackers in how to hijack planes without weapons at a place called Salman Pak. This idea just started coming out just maybe weeks after 9/11. And obviously, it had a lot of resonance, of course, right? If Saddam Hussein was training hijackers, you can only let your imagination run wild on what that would mean, what that could have meant. So that was their first big, you could call it a propaganda push, to get that story out. And supplying that story were mainly two officials who both came through the Iraqi National Congress, two so-called defectors, two Iraqi military people who were saying, they had different stories, but they alleged that they'd been at Salman Pak and they'd been at the site and they'd seen this at some points, this training going on. And that really had some resonance in some places. It seemed like it was a very important story if it was true.
What were the other storylines?
So then the other story, the next big story, was one we're all familiar with, was this sort of the story that Judith Miller did, and famously in the New York Times. It was an engineer who came forward. He was a defector, allegedly, who came forward, and he said, "I worked in Baghdad, and I was building these underground chambers." And he described what was going on. He was sealing things underground, and there were wells, and they were sealing things. And he's described all these sort of scary things he saw that he thought were WMD, nuclear or biological. There were not many specifics about what they were, but they seemed to be terrifying, very secretive programs that he said he was burying. So this guy talked to Judith Miller and others, and he told his story. He was an interesting character. He was an engineer. It seems he really was an engineer, and he may very well have worked on underground things, but on the face of it, there really wasn't that much that was incriminating. It just seemed he was doing things underground, but he had no information, apparently, about WMD. That's somehow, it sort of just all seemed suspicious, and that's the story that eventually came out, although it seemed to indicate they've got this secretive program, they're hiding something, and his importance just grew and grew and grew.
So the story was, there seems to be a secretive program, they're hiding something. He didn't say, oh, they're definitely working on WMD.
He said that he thought they were working on it, but he had no qualifications to know that. He didn't know. He would talk about things that he would talk about what he thought were sort of biological weapons, but he had no way of knowing what they were, what they would have been. There was no basis for his knowledge, even if he was telling the truth.
Can you briefly run through a couple of the other storylines that Ahmad Chalabi was putting across after September 11th?
Another big one was one called Saddam's Mistress. They found a woman who they believed had a relationship with Saddam Hussein, a romantic or sexual relationship with Saddam Hussein. And eventually they introduced the woman to ABC News, and through a long process, eventually she went public. And she talked about Saddam Hussein in ways that were very graphic. You know, it was very interesting. It was titillating. But she also alleged that Saddam Hussein, in her knowledge, was supporting Osama bin Laden, had given him cash, and that she'd seen Osama bin Laden. It was a very unlikely story. Everybody discounts it now. But it was fascinating. It got huge amounts of news, and it got huge amounts of attention, even from American intelligence. The DIA began looking into it. And they began exploring it. They gave her polygraphs. They went to visit her. And in the end, it had there was no credence to it, but it gathered a lot of public attention. So people suddenly began sort of, again, in their minds perhaps, seeing a link between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden.
Now, are you suggesting that Chalabi told her to say this?
No, I don't think there's evidence that Chalabi actually personally dealt with these defectors. He knew what was going on. There's pretty much no doubt because one INC official told me he'd written emails and letters about the defectors that he was handling to Chalabi, and Chalabi knew. There's no doubt he knew who these people were. But no, there is to this day no evidence that Chalabi himself told defectors what to say.
You spoke to a lot of journalists who printed things that you describe as Ahmed Chalabi's storylines. Tell us one of the stories that a journalist told you about how they feel they were suckered in.
There's a fantastic journalist, a really interesting man called, and his name is David Rose. He writes for Vanity Fair, and he was writing for The Observer of London. And he, after 9/11, he was looking for a way to cover terrorism really well. And he ended up linking up with Ahmed Chalabi and his Iraqi National Congress and his people. And as he describes it, he really fell under their sway. He really began to feel they were very credible. His doubts disappeared. He became just convinced that what they were saying was true, and their cause was good. He became a partisan for them. He really became steeped in them. Because now he no longer is, but he was just fascinating the way he describes he was involved. He said that when he first met Ahmed Chalabi, Chalabi sort of flattered him on his work, flattered him on how moral he was. Gradually, these tidbits they would give him, they would pan out in some way or another, he thought. Months after 9/11, suddenly this journalist was pushing for a war against Saddam Hussein.
How was he pushing?
He would write op-ed pieces. Yeah, he wrote an op-ed piece calling for war.
Oh.
He just sort of completely become to absorb this idea. And he was confused when he would talk to Chalabi. He said one time, he asked him, how come other progressive journalists don't get it? They don't understand the morality of the war. And Chalabi sort of said, well, you know, they don't have the morality that you do. He sort of calmed him down and said, they don't see it. You're more moral than they are. And later on, the guy went to do a whole bunch of these stories for Vanity Fair, for The Observer of London. He sort of helped get a lot of the Iraqi National Congress information out there into the public, and it had a great impact.
How did David Rose come to think that he was misled by Chalabi?
Oh, he didn't realize it, really, until after the invasion of Iraq. Sometime after the invasion of Iraq, David Rose says, he began to realize that, wait a second, there really were no weapons of mass destruction. And these stories he'd written seemed to just fall apart at the seams. Now, it was clear to him that much of what he'd written was not true. All these stories he'd written about weapons of mass destruction, about links to terror, about training hijackers, suddenly he realized, wait a second, he was wrong. And he had this incredible crisis of conscience. He was torn because, he began to see the horrors of war. And Chalabi's people continued to try to feed him stories. He said Chalabi, even after the war, gave him a story about how a major al-Qaeda figure had been in Iraq just a year before 9/11 and had gotten money from Saddam Hussein. And Chalabi was trying to get him to do the story, and he said now he had some suspicion. Now he was not as he didn't have the same willingness to believe everything that Chalabi said, until finally he sort of began to investigate his own reporting and thinking to himself he'd made an awful mistake.
Would you describe Chalabi as having been a key source for a lot of the pre-war reporting that reported on weapons of mass destruction being developed in Iraq, about the link between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden?
There's no doubt that Chalabi and his people were a major source for a lot of this information. For reporters of every sort, they were very good with reporters. They were wonderful with reporters, really. They were a major source for a lot of the information about Saddam's alleged links to terrorism, about Saddam's links to WMD. And also about Saddam's human rights violations, too, which they were very vocal on.
A lot of questions have been raised about the relationship that Chalabi had with Iran. So let's go there. You know, he brought this Shiite group, this Iraqi Shiite group, into alliance with the United States before the invasion. Iran is a predominantly Shiite country. Chalabi is Shiite. So what do you know about the relationship he had with the Iranians before or after the invasion?
It's really complex. And it goes to ideology, it goes to necessity, it goes to geography. He had to get in and out of Kurdistan and Iraq somehow, and he couldn't go through a lot of countries because he was obviously wanted in Jordan. He couldn't go through there, he couldn't go through other places. So he was close to Iran for a number of reasons, but his relationship before the war was complex and his relationship after the war was complex. When the CIA cut him off, he certainly worked with Iran. Even when he was getting funding from the CIA, he worked with Iranian intelligence. He had contacts with them. There's no doubt about it. Later, he had contacts with them. One question is, some people have alleged he was sort of an Iranian agent. There, I think it's probably not the case. The best analysis I've heard is that he was an Iranian agent of influence. He and Iran had similar, perhaps, goals vis-a-vis Iraq. You know, the toppling of Saddam Hussein and certain Shiite, you know, predominance and Shiite empowerment. You know, so similar goals, but not that he was getting paid or controlled by them, because most people think no one controls him. He also had ties to the very top of Iranian intelligence as it concerned Iraq. After the war, according to intelligence sources, he met with a high-level Iranian Revolutionary Guards general. And that general was supposed to be in charge of all the Iranian operations in southern Iraq. He was allegedly running very important operations against American interests and against other interests in Iraq. The U.S. intelligence believed he was very much an enemy. They believed he was involved in operations that have ended up killing Americans. And they were very disturbed that they believed Chalabi had met with him. That general's name was Ahmad Frizenda. And actually, more recently, this year, that general was actually designated by the Treasury Department as somebody who had supported terrorists in Iraq. But at the time, that it sort of went to who really was Chalabi dealing with? And this general was a very significant figure in the Iranian influence in Iraq.
So we know that Chalabi met with this Iranian general. We don't know exactly what they said to each other or what promises they made to each other.
Indeed, we don't. We do not know what happened there. Intelligence community was very suspicious about that. And now, from Chalabi's perspective, it's important to remember, you know, his view is there's no reason to think of Iran as an enemy or negatively in any way. You know, there's no reason for him, from his perspective, to be hostile towards Iran, just because Iran may be hostile to America. So he feels perfectly fine meeting with them. The main problem from an American's perspective, though, comes because he, you know, was... His group was still receiving U.S. funding and was receiving so much U.S. support. You know, he had such close ties to American intelligence figures and so much access to Americans. So that's where sort of maybe interests diverge between the two.
So what is Chalabi doing now?
Chalabi is back. He's to one degree or another. He was always sort of at this debathification committee, but he's back in a strong way in what they call services. He's a key part of Baghdad reconstruction. He works with Americans. He works with all the Iraqi ministries that deal with reconstruction. He runs something called the Services Committee, which is remarkable because he was on the outs. He was sort of trying to struggle to find new allies. He's allied himself with so many people and then made enemies of so many people in Iraq. But yet he's back. Maliki's government, the current government, has appointed him to run this committee to help coordinate, you know, reviving services in some way, getting electricity, water, and other services to the citizens of Baghdad. And it's a weird thing, but some American officials, they say, you know, at least he's competent. He may be tough to work with, and he may serve his own interests, but at least he's organized and competent. Maybe he can get something done.
An interesting thing about the Chalabi story is that, you know, he worked with the CIA. He worked with the State Department. They both gave him money. He encouraged people on Capitol Hill to pass legislation in 98, making it part of the law to overthrow Saddam Hussein, you know, a law that advocated regime change in Iraq. But now he's blaming the United States for everything that went wrong in Iraq. He's saying, you know, the United States basically blew the occupation. And I don't think a lot of people are arguing that, but he's not accepting any of the credit for the things that went wrong in Iraq, as far as I can tell.
No, that's true. No, he does not accept any blame. It's all somebody else's fault. It's all the U.S. fault. But he's very good at blaming people. He doesn't really blame Bush. He blames Bush's appointees, you know, like Bremer. But he doesn't blame Bush, you know. So it's very smart.
So he survived, right? I mean, he's alienated a lot of people. He's a really shadowy figure. He apparently was behind a lot of misinformation about Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction. But he survived. He still has a really powerful and probably lucrative position in Iraq that allows him to make a lot of deals and be a real player.
He does. And it's remarkable. He still works with American officials there. He's great to talk to. He speaks English. He's clever. He's smart. He's familiar with lots of you know, what needs to be done. He's a man to whom you can turn. And he feels like he's, you know, for Americans there, for the Iraqis there, you know, maybe they're turning to him again. No one thinks he's going to run the country. Very few people think he's going to run the country. But he's back, like you say.
So bottom line here, do you see Chalabi as an opportunist who is out for his own power in Iraq and power and influence within the United States? Or do you see him as somebody who genuinely wanted the overthrow of Saddam Hussein for the good of his own country?
I think he definitely wanted the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, and he definitely is an opportunist. He's both. He's a very complex figure. I think it's indisputable that he was passionate about overthrowing Saddam Hussein. It's also indisputable that he worked very, very hard to manipulate lots of people to get what he wanted beyond the invasion of Iraq. He definitely opposed Saddam Hussein and was sincere about that. Now, whether he would have committed his life to that if he hadn't lost his job as a banker, I don't know. But after he lost his job as a banker, because his bank was taken over and he was convicted of fraud, he did commit his life to overthrowing Saddam Hussein. There's no doubt about it. And he seemed to have been very sincere about it. And I don't think there was a doubt that he opposed Saddam Hussein, who was, of course, a very sadistic guy. And there's also no doubt that Chalabi was very manipulative and very opportunistic and manipulated a lot of people and got them to do things that he wanted them to do, which didn't always benefit them and definitely didn't always benefit the United States of America.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Aram Rostin is the author of The Man Who Pushed America to War. Rostin is a producer at the NBC Nightly News. When William F. Buckley died on February 27th, the obituaries focused as much on his distinctive verbal style as on his political influence. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg explains why Buckley could get away with using words that would have made anyone else sound insufferably pretentious or buffoonish.
The death of William F. Buckley last month sent the writers of obituaries and appreciations to their dictionaries, searching for Buckleyisms they could drop in by way of homage. The New York Times led the way when it headed its page one obituary, "William F. Buckley, Jr., 82, dies, sesquipedalian spark of right." Not surprisingly, that header mystified quite a few readers, particularly since the article underneath it didn't give the game away until paragraph 24, when it finally let on that sesquipedalian means characterized by the use of long words. Still, if you're going to have people scratching their heads over a word in somebody's obituary, who better than his? I counted more than a dozen of those stories that use the word sesquipedalian, though most weren't as coy as the Times about explaining the word. In Newsweek, Evan Thomas described Buckley as a lover of big words, a sesquipedalian, as he might say. Actually, Buckley did call himself that on occasion, though he knew that you can only use sesquipedalian as an adjective to describe someone. It's not a noun like Episcopalian. But one way or another, the word is particularly apt for him, and not just because of his fondness for polysyllables. It was coined by the Roman poet Horace, who referred to poets who use sesquipedalia verba, which literally means words a foot and a half long. The word was Horace's little joke, an example of the very thing it was ridiculing, and it has been tinged with mockery ever since. So it accords nicely with the slightly self-mocking persona that Buckley fashioned for himself. The slouch, the drawling patrician voice, the arching eyebrows and the darting lizard tongue, not to mention the overcooked language itself, it all served to avert the irritation that his highfalutin vocabulary might otherwise have engendered. We Americans tend to be tough on erudition that's untempered by humor, or at least when it comes from one of our own. Unfairly or not, we'll tax George Will with pedantry for using a word that we'll receive with an indulgent smile when it comes from Christopher Hitchens. Use a fancy word in public, and you risk being accused of affectation, elitism, or simply what people used to call putting on the style. With the exception of Senator Pat Moynihan, I can't think of any modern public figure but Buckley who could charm away those impressions while still getting people to take him and his language seriously. David Fry and Robin Williams could get his voice dead on, but his verbal style proved surprisingly hard to capture, even for those who were close to him. In his appreciation of Buckley, National Review's Jonah Goldberg described him affectionately as the peripatetic proselytizer of polysyllabism. But that doesn't sound like Buckley. What it brings to mind is Spiro Agnew disgorging one of those prefabricated chunks like nattering nabobs of negativism that his speechwriter William Safire used to cook up for him. It's the same sort of thing that Bill O'Reilly is doing when he over-enunciates words like bloviate and opine, a big word buffoonery that actually implies a disdain for language. These are people who choose their words as if they were shopping for lawn ornaments. There are people who do this polysyllabic wordplay more engagingly. Safire, for example, ever since he's been filing under his own byline. But this is just a weekend avocation for Safire, whereas Buckley's devotion to recondite words was profound and passionate, and sometimes maybe a little immoderate. Word collectors always have to tread a fine line between flattering their readers' erudition and basking in their own, and Buckley didn't always keep his balance. He had a weakness for what the critic H.W. Fowler described as Wardour Street words, after the street in Soho where Londoners used to shop for decorative bric-a-brac. He couldn't resist using catechize in place of question or grill, vaticination for forecast, and eo ipso for in and of itself. Of course, he would have said that those words had nuances that were absent in their everyday synonyms, and that using them encouraged people to stretch their vocabularies. He wrote once that asking somebody to avoid uncommon words is like advising a composer that he may not use diminished chords in his next symphony. That's fair enough, but reading Buckley, you sometimes wish that he'd confined his composing to the white keys. Take the time he worked albescent into a description of the sea in an account he wrote for People magazine in 1980 about crossing the Atlantic in a sailboat. It was an elegant touch, particularly for readers whose Latin was up to recognizing that the word meant whitish. But even for them, albescent doesn't conjure up a specific shade of white the way a concrete word like chalk or frost or ivory does. That's the price you pay for using sesquipedalian words. The higher they soar, the further removed they are from the world of feeling and sensation on the ground below. And as Horace said, you have to set them aside if you want to touch the heart. Buckley had trouble renouncing that language, and the failure came at a cost. His penchant for lexical bling-bling helped make him a cultural personage, but it also left him a lesser writer than his gifts might have allowed him to become. Still, the woods are full of gifted writers, and there was only one of him.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.